Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Earthdawn Survival Guide, the podcast for all disciplines, paths, players, and game masters with your questers, Josh and Dan. I am Dan. And on today's podcast, we will be discussing all things quizzical yet again, because this is the continuation, part B, part two of our email palooza with Josh, where we ran so long last time we had to break it in half. So literally, this is the second half. We'll get to the questions in just a second. And if you have any questions for us, drop us a line at edsgpodcast@gmail.com. Next one up is coming from Josh. No, not that Josh. Good morning and well met. I'm a longtime fan of Earthdawn and amateur tabletop RPG designer. I've taken notice of the success of OSR, NSR, POSR hacks of D&D and wanted to try my hand at reducing Earthdawn down to a less intimidating rule set. However, I don't want to infringe or do anything that may upset FASA or the good folks working on Earthdawn. My plan is to make the game system Earthdawn-like and Earthdawn Light, but nothing close to one-on-one. I won't be including any explanation of the setting beyond hinting at it and outright directing people to buy the current edition books to learn about it. However, I'm worried that even using words like Earthdawn, Barsafe, Tiskrang, Nethermancer, and Namegivers might be crossing a line. Do y'all have any non-legally binding advice on how to proceed in a manner that is most respectful to the creators, team members, and rights holders of Earthdawn? P.S. I'm loving the show. Thank you for your stewardship and promotion of this great game. Josh. No, not that Josh.
Yeah, not that Josh. Broadly speaking, and again, this is not legally binding, but generally speaking, the way that we approach things, and certainly the attitude that I have towards it, which is that if you are doing a fan work, whether that is sort of doing your own take on Earthdawn with a slightly different system, as long as you're saying, like, not really providing a whole lot of details on the setting beyond what the minimum required is in order to present your game, you know, that, like, you've got dwarves and obsidian and Tiskrang and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And if you are making it available without selling anything, that's really where the hard line sort of ends up coming across is
fair.
If you are making it available for free, generally speaking, we greatly appreciate if you put a disclaimer in as part of it that Earthdawn is a registered trademark of FASA. Any use of trademarked terms is not intended as a challenge to those. This is a fan work and not officially endorsed. Some kind of disclaimer to that effect. And if you are otherwise not making big swaths of actual printed material available for free, then, yeah, using terms like Namegiver or Earthdawn or whatever is generally fine. There's a disclaimer that was at the end of the Legends of Earthdawn podcast.
Yes, yes.
That Cliff has at the end, and that's sort of the standard disclaimer. If you look at the YouTube versions of these episodes, the splash screen has a similar disclaimer in there as part of it. Mm-hmm. Because while I am part of FASA, you know, this is not a fully officially endorsed or licensed kind of situation.
Which is why it's free.
That's not the only reason why, but that is, you know, that's part of why. But there are folks who have done or are doing things that there is a certain amount of legitimacy that they want, where they are looking to do some kind of license or other. Mm-hmm. And I am not the person to talk to about that. That is something where you would want to reach out to Ross. But if your general idea is, I'm looking to tinker as a designer with a system that is inspired by and sort of a take on Earthdawn, that, you know, you could use that. There's a, I think it's called
Vagrant Workshop. Vagrant Workshop did.
Yeah, Vagrant Workshop did a game called Age of Legend, which is officially licensed.
Yeah.
Uses the Freeform Universal system. So they did kind of a rules light thing. That's not really an OSR. OSR, if you're not familiar, stands for Old School Revival, is one of the ways that that's kind of viewed. It's the idea of going back to the old, original, basic Dungeons & Dragons or advanced Dungeons & Dragons stuff and trying to recapture a particular aspect of the gameplay, or going back to a style of gameplay that is retro or reminiscent in some way of how stories about those old days were. It is frequently connected to Dungeons and Dragons stuff, but there have been now sort of multiple generations of design that have come out of that, that are now spawning their own ecosystems of stuff. There's some really interesting, like, sort of indie design that has come about as a result of that. But what I was trying to think of is, I think it's called Fourth World. Somebody did a Dungeon World-like hack. Dungeon World is a Powered by the Apocalypse D&D style game, that they did sort of a Dungeon World style hack for Earthdawn, where they have, like, Powered by the Apocalypse style playbooks for the various disciplines and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I have glanced at it. I haven't really looked at it in any depth, or certainly not played it to see how true it is. That's a thing that's out there, and it's fine. The big concerns are you are not making huge swaths of our copyrighted book material available for free.
Yeah.
And that you are not charging for it, making money off of the use of FASA's trademarks and copyrighted material.
Intellectual property, yeah.
Writing up your own adventures and making them available online, that's fine. That's great. Coming up with your own disciplines or paths. Personal websites aren't so much of a thing anymore, but if you put stuff out like that and you make it available and it gets noticed and it appears to be of good quality and whatnot, in a sense, that's kind of how Morgan got involved with working on fourth edition, is that he had this extensive website with a whole bunch of stuff that was of good quality and clearly had gone into a lot of thought. And so we reached out to him and went, hey, do you want to work on this new edition with us?
Yes.
And the rest is history. No promises in terms of, oh, hey, if you do this, then you'll be able to, like, work with us officially.
Good job. Yeah.
But there's personal websites and things like Substack or your Facebook page or Discords or whatever, places that you can kind of share this stuff if you want to do it. I think it's all cool.
Yeah. Which actually leads into our next email from Sven. Yes. Earthdawn podcast question. Hello, dudes. Sven here from Books of Tomorrow fanzine for homebrewers. The magazine was founded by Earthdawn Publishing Trust in the days of second edition books of Earthdawn Publishing. As a lack and absence of Earthdawn Journal or any other Earthdawn fanzine, fans there started to publish this PDF magazine now and then. Earthdawn Publishing Trust, the EDPT.com, where the place fans went to talk in forums and create homebrewed stuff. Then Redbrick came along and announced they wanted to republish the classic Earthdawn stuff, and the rest is history. As I remember, I don't think you haven't mentioned this resource in your podcast yet. We had not. Maybe once. All issues are free and can be found under the files in the Earthdawn Guild. Homebrewers are welcome to submit material for the next issues. More information in the Earthdawn Guild. By the way, a funny note, did you know Josh once wrote and edited for the BOTM fanzine as well? He is credited.
Yes. In fact, I did know that. The Earthdawn Publishing Trust was actually created prior to the announcement of Living Room Games 2nd Edition. In the aftermath of the announcement that Earthdawn was going to be shut down, a few of us who were very active on the Earthdawn mailing list at the time, there was myself, there was Kathy Chachowski. I believe I'm pronouncing her last name correctly. She has actually sort of popped back in and out. She's done a little bit of editing work, even for, like, FASA present day incarnation. Attila Hatvanger, I think, was his name. He's another one. There were, like, three or four of us, like, really early on that were big into trying to see Earthdawn continue. And I think, like, one of the initial thoughts that we had was, oh, hey, this got shut down, but we know Bar Save at War was coming. Is this something that we could do? And then second edition got announced, and it continued on for a little bit, and like many enthusiastic fan endeavors, it has sort of risen and fallen in terms of the amount of activity going on with it. But yeah, there were several issues. It was sort of like an attempt to do like an Earthdawn Journal sort of thing in the aftermath of the original publication ending. So yeah, I don't remember exact specifics at this point, but I remember it being started up and doing a little bit of work early on, and then I forget exactly whether I stopped working on that because I started working with Redbrick or exactly what happened, but my involvement with it directly kind of faded away as life did what it does. It is sort of still going on with occasional stuff coming out, and it's not a bad place if you want to have some of your own sort of homebrewed or creative material put into a place for other people to see.
Yeah. I downloaded a number of things from the Earth Dawn Publishing Trust and the Bajados fanzine as well, and the Earth Dawn Journal. So yeah, I've frequented all of those places.
Yeah. There's no official oversight or anything in terms of the publishing trust stuff. We don't have time to vet it or anything. So caveat emptor to a certain extent.
Agreed.
Just like in the original Earth Dawn Journal, there is some stuff that is really good. There is some stuff that is okay. And then there are some things that aren't so great. That's fine. It's just nice to see the enthusiasm and the creativity, and people's opinions of the various things will be different based on what it is.
Absolutely. But
that's cool. If that's something that you're interested in, it is a place that you can make that stuff available.
Agreed. So now to Sven's questions. I know there has been some discussion in several forums earlier, but I want to bring this up in the podcast as I feel I didn't get a comfortable answer in the other places. And I think this is an important topic for the listeners as well, and a subject we have not explored yet. Legend points and legend point awards. I think you could have dedicated a whole episode about this subject, so here we go. Please explain how the new legend point award system challenge rating works in the 4th edition, because it's very different from earlier editions, Sven claims. I see now you award legend points out of circle 4 to 5 criterias now. So legend point awards on defeating monsters, they are categorized in a strength/circle levels now. What is the big difference besides not giving monsters kill awards anymore? We'll answer that question first.
Yeah, so the challenge ratings that's listed in the 4th edition GM's guide and the companion and so forth, those are a rough idea of what equivalent difficulty they would be for player characters. That is sort of a starting point to determine how difficult a challenge a particular opponent might be for a group or a player character group. But it is just sort of the starting point of that. What you would then want to do is follow the more in-depth comparisons that are provided as well in the GM's guide, where you compare attack steps to defense ratings and vice versa and that sort of thing, to get a sense of, for your particular party of adventurers, how much of a challenge is this likely to be. If you've got a creature with a high physical defense and low mystic defense, but your group doesn't really have any mystic attacks to speak of, that's going to be a much greater challenge than it would be for a group that's got, say, more magicians as part of it. Mm-hmm. Simply because its weaknesses can be taken advantage of a little bit more easily with a different makeup. If you've got a group that's got air sailors and troubadours and weaponsmiths, as opposed to warriors and swordmasters and sky raiders, you're going to have a different situation when it comes to physical combat, even against the very same creature at the same player character circles, simply because of the tools and skills and numbers that are available to them are going to be a little bit different in terms of that. That challenge rating is really just here is a starting point to give you an idea of roughly what kind of difficulty an encounter against this sort of thing or a group of these things is likely to be. But you need to look a bit more in depth to work things out to a greater extent. The higher the challenge rating, the more important it becomes to take a look at that comparison, because the more powerful a group becomes, the more tools they have at their disposal, the more combinations and synergies that they have, it can make a fight or an encounter that might seem difficult actually end up being a pushover, or vice versa. If you have a group that really doesn't do a great job, say, of taking advantage of their synergies or abilities, an opponent that is designed with the understanding that those are going to be taking place might end up being a greater challenge than you might otherwise expect. That is separate from providing legend awards, at least in my mind.
Fair.
The legend award that is given for overcoming obstacles is one of the aspects of an adventure, is one of the aspects of a session. You've got a particular objective that the group is trying to achieve. That's the session goal. Perhaps as part of a larger story arc, there are challenges that they need to overcome in order to further their objectives, in order to reach that goal that they have set for themselves. And that may include fighting monsters. It may involve navigating treacherous terrain, mountains, badlands, forests, whatever, dealing with some kind of environmental hazard. Mm-hmm. It might not involve fighting. It might involve investigation or negotiation or talking to NPCs, whatever kind of actions that they take to further their goals and the obstacles that they overcome in order to achieve those. That is something that they gain experience, that they earn legend to do. They earn legend for finding treasure, particularly treasure that is representative of the challenges that they have overcome. Unusual bits of monsters that they might have slain, thread items that they might recover from an abandoned care, bits of lore, books, fragments from a library, any number of strange or unusual things, not simply just silver and gold.
Yeah.
And so splitting apart the legend award for overcoming obstacles compared to the idea of you earn legend points for killing / defeating opponents. Mm-hmm. I feel that if you award legend for killing monsters, then that's what people are going to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The perception is that this lightning lizard is worth 150 legend points, then what people are going to do because they want those legend points is kill the lightning lizard.
Yeah.
If all that you actually have in a situation is this lightning lizard is an obstacle that you need to get past in order to further your objectives, in order to achieve your goal in the adventure, then you don't necessarily have to kill it. There are other ways that you might deal with that obstacle, that you might deal with that challenge in order to get past it. So you no longer need to care that it is worth a particular number of legend points. You just have these objectives, you have these obstacles, you overcome the obstacle, you get the award for overcoming the obstacle, however it might be that you do that.
Yeah. So let's give everybody an example real quick. Let's say the Crojan, because it's one of Lou's favorites, and you mentioned that a little while ago. The Crojan is listed as a journeyman or a fifth circle challenge. And right. We're going to reference page 120 in the Game Master's book for the Legend Award table. So fifth circle would be equal to a challenge rating of fifth circle. So that Legend Award for avoiding the Crojan, engaging with the Crojan, killing the Crojan, whichever way you want to handle it, 5 to 1,500 points for that single Legend Award. Correct?
Yes, sort of, but not really.
Which is fine. Like I said, I want to give everybody a concrete example, more or less, so they can kind of work through the process along with you.
Yeah, that's, I feel, still trying to tie the fact that this is listed as a fifth circle opponent, so it must be worth however many legend points you would get for a fifth circle obstacle.
Yes.
That's not necessarily the case, because mm-hmm. you could have, say, an eighth or ninth circle group that still needs to get past a pack of Crojan in order to further their goals. Again, whether they kill them or whether they got a high circle beastmaster that is able to distract them, or whether they are able to stealth their way past it, or because they've got powerful magic, just fly past them or whatever.
Put them to sleep, yeah.
If it is an obstacle that would be a challenge for their group based on the number of them that they are facing or the circumstances or whatever, if they overcome that obstacle, however many obstacles you might place in their way, because what you could do, rather than saying, okay, this is a fifth circle group, I need to put them up against fifth circle challenges. Well, no, you don't have to. You could provide multiple challenges made up of second and third circle opponents, maybe with more of them. Maybe the fights themselves wouldn't be necessarily that difficult, but if you have multiples of them, there are still resources perhaps that are going to be expended, choices that might need to be made. It's just basically the idea is when you are planning and playing through your session, the concept is that you have an objective, you have a goal that you are looking to achieve in that session. And in order to achieve that goal, there are obstacles that you need to overcome. And honestly, for me, I just kind of eyeball and say, how many encounters were there? How many challenges were overcome in the course of this session? And if there were a low number, then I'll give a lower number on the range of the legend points. And if there were more of them, or it was more intense or whatever, then I will provide a higher number on that range. But I don't tie the challenge rating, the listed difficulty for an opponent or creature from the Game Master's Guide, to a particular fixed legend award that I give as a result of fighting them or bypassing them or whatever you end up doing with them.
Fair. So more on the legend award table, and again on page 120, is more for the circle, the average circle of the characters involved. So if you've got... So if you've got four characters, all at third circle, what they should be getting is the third circle legend award for overcoming those obstacles.
Right. And you should be choosing obstacles that are appropriate for that group, and the listed difficulties for the opponents can help guide you in terms of what types of opposition you may put in their way, but the two are not super linked to each other in my mind.
Yeah.
One is a tool to help you to help guide you in terms of selecting what should be appropriate challenges for a group of a particular circle. The other is a tool that is based loosely on how much it costs to advance your character as a kind of pacing mechanic of how quickly a group or a player character would be able to advance through the ranks and circles of their discipline.
Agreed. So, next question. Why was it chosen to change the Legend Point Award system in the first place? Why did it need a change? To make it more abstract versus more concrete? Or was it too alike to D&D? If it's a bigger difference in the Legend Award system between earlier editions? Just, Sven wants to hear the story. And we may not have time for that.
Yeah, well, so, a couple of things. I felt... And this is something I think that was felt by other folks at the time when I started working on Earthdawn Classic, when I was working with Red Brick on that. The amount of legend points needed to advance a character into higher circles, particularly once you started getting up into upper journeymen and then into like warden and master tier characters, was very, very high, and the recommended legend awards that were listed in the first edition Earthdawn book did not keep pace. If you sort of graphed the curves of how much legend you needed to advance and how much legend you actually were being, it was recommended to award you, those curves got further and further apart the higher in circle that your character got. I think I did some calculations at one point, and under the original first edition suggestions, if you did nothing but improve your character's talent ranks and only the minimum amount required in order to advance in circle, just optimizing for circle advancement, not factoring in purchasing karma, which was something in first edition.
Yes.
No group patterns, no thread items.
No nothing.
Nothing but focusing purely on the minimum number of talents required to advance in your discipline's circle and looking at just one discipline. I think it was something between 5 to 6 years of weekly play to reach 15th circle. And I remember, because around that time, this was after third edition had come out, Wizards of the Coast had done a whole bunch of surveying and, for lack of a better term, like market research and whatnot, and finding out like what people's actual experiences were playing D&D.
Yeah.
How long was the typical campaign and various things like that, knowing that I had run a more or less weekly game under first edition from brand new First Circle characters for 3 years or something like that. This first like really long term game that I ran, the player characters were only getting to like eighth ish circle at the end when that game kind of finally wrapped up. The second long-term game that I ran, which was under third edition, likewise ran for multiple years, and I was still only in like eighth or ninth circle when that game finally wrapped up, because the advancement pace is really, really slow.
Yep.
Based on those initial calculations of how long it took, recalculated the recommended legend awards to change the rate of advancement, again, based purely on optimizing for circle advancement. That was one change in terms of just the raw numbers on the table. It was just a sense of, it is very uncommon for games to get into those 9th, 10th, 11th circle ranges very often. Peter the long-term games that you hear about running multiple years, getting to 14th, 15th circle in multiple disciplines or whatever.
Yeah.
Honestly, those are the stories that stick around because I think they're a little uncommon. They're the sort of exception, really. From my own experience, having run multiple long-term games, I never had a game that got to that point. But also, it wasn't even really like, oh, this is too much like D&D. Because even if you look at the first edition rules, their breakdown was still in the same categories, in achieving objectives, in overcoming obstacles, in finding treasure, in role-playing bonuses and things like that. They like basically had the same four or five categories. The only difference there is that creatures were given specific legend awards, and the thought was that you could balance your encounter by saying, okay, a third circle group should receive X award for overcoming obstacles. I'm going to select creatures whose legend point award totals add up to that or within that ballpark when putting together my encounters.
Yeah.
And I don't think, honestly, that that ever worked particularly well because of the, you would still need to go and balance the encounters the way that I talked about comparing attack ratings and defense ratings and all of that other stuff, which was something that was taken from first edition as well. I think that was in the GM pack along with the screen. So it was just some refinement of some things that were already there, not seeing the need to have specific legend award values for creatures, which in first edition were ostensibly based on the various attribute defense attack power steps and whatnot of the creature, and just kind of saying, okay, we're going to create the creature. He's got this numbers. Roughly speaking, if we've got a creature that we're kind of designing to be a rough challenge for, say, a high novice character group, we're going to expect, based on these numbers, that attack steps are typically going to be in this range. So we want them to have a defense rating in a similar range so that it's kind of roughly equal. Designing creatures and the stats and whatnot, there is some science and underlying math to it, but there's some art to it as well, based on what you're trying to do thematically with the creature and what it role it serves and things like that. I don't know that that covers like every detail, but from my standpoint, those were the two big things. One was just rescaling the actual suggested awards to allow for a little bit faster advancement so that people could get out of those really low circles into the higher novice and into journeyman circles a little bit more quickly, and also just make it more possible for people to get into those even higher circles without quite as much dedication. Because as I got older, the idea of a regular, frequent game where we could devote a lot of time stopped seeming as likely.
Fair. Back to Sven. I like how it's now a Legend Point Awards on the quality on role-playing your character performs, helping the Game Master create a good atmosphere, and on original solving of problems without a kill tracker.
Yeah.
Nonviolent performing role-playing is an artisan skill, too. Besides these, reach goals and find magic items goals are awarded as well. So how do we upgrade or convert old, non-updated creature horror adventure Legend Point Awards from earlier editions to fourth edition?
Here's the way that I feel about this. And again, this is sort of just me talking about it. If you are looking at old adventures like Mists of Betrayal, like Infected, like Shattered Pattern, and whatnot, you could simply just grab the stat blocks from those adventures.
Scaled.
Check them to make sure that they are appropriately scaled for the player characters. Tweak them as you might feel necessary. And then just award Legend based on the guidelines in the 4th edition GM guide.
Yeah, easy.
Okay, our objective for this session is to get here. They're going to get the Legend Award for doing that. These are the obstacles in the way. They'll get the Legends Award for that. Rather than worrying about like the specific numbers, because those old adventures also still had the Legend Point breakdowns of here's what they get for achieving the objective. Here's what they get for the enemies. The old adventures would have a specific, like, you get this many Legend of Point Award for defeating these enemies and this many for these and whatnot. But just kind of combining that and saying, okay, all of these in this session, these are the obstacles. Here's, you know, what that award's going to be. You could certainly do that. Just basically using the existing story framework of those adventures and adapting the mechanics and stat blocks of and difficulty numbers of the opposition and obstacles in place to best suit the needs of your group, which honestly, you probably should be doing anyway. Mm-hmm. If you can. And that's whether you're running it under the original rules or under new editions or whatever, but just following those same guidelines. I don't feel like there is necessarily a wrong way to do it. The newer version is, I feel, just a little bit more of a refinement of the philosophy behind the original one that's just recognizing and sort of cutting away a bit of unnecessary stuff that was just kind of an aspect of game design back in the early to mid 90s.
Fair. In the end of the Creatures of Barsave first edition book, there are guidelines on how to make new beasts and how much Legend Point Award you should give for a homebrewed monster. Have similar instructions been created for fourth edition or plans for it in the rumored upcoming Creatures of Barsave book?
There are some rough guidelines that are used in-house when it comes to designing creatures, but there's nothing formalized that we are currently planning to release as part of a creature's book or anything along those lines. Similar to the spell design rules,
fair,
said with air quotes around it. There are sort of guidelines, but there's as much art as math behind them. Generally speaking, the baseline that I kind of operate on is I presume that a primary frontline combatant, like a warrior or a swordmaster or something, is typically going to have a step 7 in their primary attribute, in this case, dexterity.
Mm-hmm.
Will have a rank in their primary attack talent at least equal to their circle, if not one or two ranks higher.
Yeah.
And so, again, if you're talking about a fourth circle character, you're looking at a step 7 dex plus, say, a rank 5 melee weapons. So you're looking at a step 12 there. Depending on the discipline, they might have abilities that will add bonuses to that, like you would have Maneuver from a Swordmaster or Mystic Aim from an Archer or something like that that is likely to add some additional bonus points into that on average. And so a roughly equivalent challenge to a fourth circle, if you're making a physical combat opponent, is probably going to need to have a physical defense in the 12, 13, 14 range in order to, at least initially, pose a potential challenge to a physically
powerful specced
character because you want them to have a physical defense that they're going to have a decent chance of hitting, but that they are not going to walk through really easily. And you can kind of make things up in other ways by, oh, well, it's got a little bit of a lower physical defense, but it's got a lot higher armor.
Yeah.
It may hit more often, but it's going to absorb more of that damage because of its armor, because of the way that the changes to armor defeating hits and extra successes and like that do. And so what you do is you do a similar kind of calculation just in reverse that you do when you are taking an already existing creature and comparing it to your player characters.
Yeah.
Look at the numbers and go, okay, based on its values, its defense ratings look like kind of in the rough ballpark that we would expect the primary action steps of a fourth circle character would be. So it's probably, you know, roughly speaking, about a fourth circle challenge.
Fair.
That's the way that I approach it. Yeah, there are some internal guidelines, particularly like once you're getting into like a journeyman tier opponent, you're going to want to have them have multiple actions. Sort of a general guideline is novice opponents are typically going to have one action that they can take on their turn, maybe with a special ability that provides them additional actions under certain circumstances, like Cadavermen, for example. Mm-hmm. But when you get into journeyman tier, you want to have a second action because a lot of disciplines start picking up their second attack talents, whether second weapon or second attack or whatever. And you just kind of want to try and balance that action economy. That's sort of generally it. And since we no longer have specific legend awards that are tied to a creature's stats anymore, then we don't have to worry about that anymore. It's just a general guideline of, this is roughly where this creature sits in comparison to what we expect, quote unquote, typical player characters to be. And so that's the guideline of what difficulty of opponent it is.
Fair. We have three more questions from Sven. Another related philosophical question. Why give different legend points to the players from what circle they've reached versus a flat sum divided equally between the players attending the game? In groups with players in different circles, I feel the system is very unfair. The lower circles get less legend points to spend, reaching the same goal, doing the same thing. This has also been done in several earlier editions as well, by the way. This system makes people not choose the magician disciplines because they will be put behind due to the low legend point cost of spells. In my games, I give a flat score to all my players. I know other game masters rule out legend point cost on buying new spells. Why all the other changes and still stick to this old rule?
Well, I don't award different legend point awards based on the player character's circle either. I don't say, okay, because your third circle, I'm giving you 300 legend points for achieving the adventure objective. And because your second circle, I'm only giving you 200. I don't do that either.
No.
I calculate the average circle of the group.
Mm-hmm.
And award everybody the same legend award based on that average result. That helps those players that might be a little bit behind in terms of their advancement, particularly if, depending on the way that you're running things, if you've got a group of third circle characters and one of those characters dies and they come in with a brand new first circle character, it's going to help that first circle character catch up a lot more easily because they are going to get bigger awards because the average circle of the group is third or like 2.8 or whatever, but I would generally just round that up.
Yes.
Honestly, most of the game masters of my acquaintance do that same sort of thing. They award the same amount of legend points to everybody, regardless of what circle that the character is. It's just that it is the average circle of the group that determines what that base award is.
Yeah.
That's what I've always done, even back in the first edition days. I didn't provide different awards for characters because one had decided to advance and go tall and get into third circle, whereas another character, say, picked up an additional discipline or decided to go wide by picking up more talents than this other character. Even when you're not talking about magicians and spending legend points for spells and whatnot, I agree. I don't think it's fair to do it that way. And so I've always just given everybody the same Legend Award. In my first long-term game, I varied slightly for the role-playing award. I had everybody provide ratings or notes on all of the other players in the table and then calculated based on the score, like how much that they got. So there might be like a 10 or 20 point difference between the total awards that everybody would get, but there was certainly nothing that was based on the actual character, individual character circle.
Yeah, I remember finding a paragraph, and I can't find it at the moment, about averaging out everybody's circle so that the lower circle characters got more points so they could get, they could achieve that average faster and therefore get to the circle with everybody else quicker.
Yeah, that's one of those things that if I were able to go back in time, I would probably rewrite that section to be a little bit more clearer in that regard. Fair. Because that's the way that I have always handled it.
Yeah.
And much like I was surprised even several years later about the way that some people handled item history, for example, that I was always operating under a certain assumption, and it didn't occur to me that people might not interpret that the same way. Language is weird. Writing can be unclear, y'all. But yeah, because of the way that I have always run it, I don't feel like that was something that ever changed. Every time it sort of comes up where people will say, would ask, why do you give different circle characters different legend awards? A lot of the response has been, we don't.
Yeah. Took me one session to learn that. And I was like, oh, right, I screwed up. And I found that paragraph and I used it. So last two questions. I see the Quester and Elven Nations books are out of print. Will they be revised before a new print, or will it be the same content, or will they be just collectibles now because they're not going to do a second printing? That's all one question, even though there's three question marks.
Yes. Currently, Elven Nations and Questors are out of print or very virtually out of print. One of them, there are none in stock at our distributor, Studio 2. And the other one had less than 20 copies left. And I don't remember which is which offhand. The question has been raised internally about what is going to be done with them. And I don't know that a final decision has been made. Personally, I would really like to see a new print run of Questors be done. I think that's a book that is one that, that similar to the Player's Guides and the Companions and Mystic Paths, should probably continue to be available.
I agree.
Because of the rules options that it provides. I don't know necessarily that Elven Nations requires a reprint, but if either of them do end up getting reprinted, all that would be likely to happen with those is that any known errata or clarifications that could be incorporated into the text would be done for a reprint, the same way that we did for the Player's Guides and the other books that have seen multiple printings at this point.
Fair.
We are aware of the out-of-print status of those, and there have been some internal discussions about what to do about that, but no final decision yet.
Okay, last one. Else, I'm happy about your show and listening to your podcast every week. Love it. And also Lou's anecdotes about every episode he posts in the Earthdawn Guild Facebook group the week after. Has become a tradition I also love to read. We get an even bigger depth in the subjects you put up. As you see, I put the Lou questions for episode 200 at the end of this. I see some stuff Lou writes that should had a reply by you again. Do you read his replies? Is the last question from Sven.
Yes, I do.
So do I.
I don't honestly feel a lot of times that there's anything that I much need to add to them. But yeah, I read them and I appreciate them. I am looking forward to having Lou on the show. We have been getting emails for Lou from folks. There were several emails that we got that were just questions for Lou. We are holding off on those until then. I'm only just back from my vacation here a few days ago, so I haven't had a chance to start talking to Lou about scheduling for when we will do that. Dan's got some stuff going on himself here coming up that might delay that a little bit, but we'll get that all worked out. There are actually some things that have sort of come up that I don't know that I've heard Lou talk about before, so we will definitely have some things to go over when we finally get around to that. But yeah, no, I've known Lou for quite a number of years now, our sort of initial acquaintance from the Earthdawn mailing list back in the 90s, and our sort of continued acquaintance and relationship that has gone on now for close to 30 years. There was some talk of me possibly stopping by to just pay him a visit earlier this summer when I was down in Massachusetts for my high school reunion. And scheduling just didn't work out for that because I had to get back home sooner than I had originally thought I needed to. I appreciate the insights that he provides when he does provide them, and I'm looking forward to talking with him.
No, I love the anecdotes he's got on those. Those are fun little stories. I read them as well on the Facebook groups because it's Lou. Why would you not read those? And I'm glad he chimes in. It's fun. So until next time, folks, this was a double episode of Email Palooza. We'll probably break this one in half and split it out for you for two different episodes in the feed. But until next time, email us with any other questions you have for your legend and your Legend Point Award.
Good night, everybody.